And our sermon text is Song of Solomon, chapter 7, beginning at verse 11 through chapter 8 and verse 4. Come, my beloved, let us go out into the fields and lodge in the villages. Let us go out early to the vineyards and see whether the vines have budded, whether the grape blossoms have opened and the pomegranates are in bloom. There I will give you my love. The mandrakes give forth fragrance, and beside our doors are all choice fruits, new as well as old, which I have laid up for you, O my beloved. Oh, that you were like a brother to me, who nursed at my mother's breasts. If I found you outside, I would kiss you, and none would despise me. I would lead you and bring you into the house of my mother, she who used to teach me. I would give you spiced wine to drink, the juice of my pomegranate. His left hand is under my head, and his right hand embraces me. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. In a classic psychology experiment from the 1970s, a very clever psychologist named Walter Mischel placed a marshmallow in front of children and offered them a choice. They could either enjoy the treat now or wait a brief period of time in order to get two snacks. When the experimenter left the room, many of the kids immediately ate the marshmallow, but some of the kids were able to put off the urge to enjoy that treat now and wait for the reward of getting two delicious goodies later on. What Mischel discovered was that the kids who were able to delay gratification had a number of advantages later on over the kids who simply couldn't wait. The children who had waited for the marshmallow performed better academically years later than kids that ate the treat right away. Those who delayed their gratification also displayed fewer behavioral problems and later had much higher SAT scores, too. That's what you get for eating too many marshmallows, right? That really wasn't the point. But according to the website verywellmind.com, delayed gratification is choosing a long-term reward over immediate gratification, putting off what we want now so that we can perhaps get something else, something better later on. Song of Solomon, as we've been unpacking, is an exercise in delayed gratification, isn't it? To some extent. And much, much more. Shulamith, in her probation with the harem of Solomon, once again, the idea of the harem being the setting for the Song of Solomon, makes it coherent as wisdom literature. None of the other approaches do. Shulamith, in her probation with the harem of Solomon, has deliberately chosen to follow the biblical covenant model of marriage between one man and one woman, delaying the perks of covenant marriage, that is, things like sex and intimacy and pleasure, delaying the perks of covenant marriage for the responsibilities of covenant marriage as well, that is, the witness of God and family and community. That's the upshot of her adjuration. Do not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. Solomon and the harem, on the other hand, have been an exercise in immediate gratification. Solomon setting out, as he told us in Ecclesiastes, to plumb the depths of pleasure, right? Skimming the perks of covenant marriage, sex and intimacy and pleasure, while despising its responsibilities, that one man, one woman, mutual fidelity, the vows before God and community. The harem, by definition, makes hash of the biblical vision of marriage from Genesis to Revelation. Now, in our text today, as we come to the we approach the conclusion of the song, we will conclude next week, we see the discreet stirring up and awakening of love, finally, in Shulamith and the shepherd boy. Indeed, love is pleased to be stirred up and awakened now. The reward for delaying gratification in love is about to be bestowed. Let's look to our text today and see this reflected, shall we? 3 points I want to make with you today from our text. And our first one from chapter 7, verses 11 to 13. You have an outline on the inside flap of your bulletin if you want to follow along. Point number one, 11 to 13, chapter 7. Beckoned. Shulamith is beckoning now, her shepherd boy. Biblical covenant love is pleased to be stirred and awakened between Shulamith and the shepherd boy. So 7, 11 to 13 tells us today. Now we've seen up to this point, it has been Solomon who has on 3 different occasions sung 3 rock and roll songs of seduction, if we can put it that way. 3 rock and roll songs of seduction. That's our contemporary setting of the harem, right? Backed by his chorus of harem girls, which in your ESV translation anyway are denominated the others, right? Infuriating generic term, but it's actually the harem girls. And we have carefully observed how these boilerplate performances, standard fare, sung before every young virgin being inaugurated into the harem, right? All of them designed, you're the most beautiful girl ever. Yeah, you're number 731, but you're still the most beautiful girl ever, right? Sung before every young virgin being inaugurated into the harem, these boilerplate performances were designed to flatter Shulamith as a stunning beauty, which she was. These are the daughters of Jerusalem. And persuading her that she should not waste all of her gifts, on her obscure village shepherd boy, but rather to give them to the wisest king who had ever lived, the Elvis of Israel, Solomon. Today, we have a substantial shift in voice now, too, from these 3 rock and roll seduction songs performed by the Elvis of Israel, Solomon. Shift in gender, case, and number, and in context, too. So we can identify the speaker as Shulamith, addressing her beloved. This is her beloved she is speaking to, her shepherd boy. Her shepherd boy has always been the beloved, her beloved, and their place of fellowship has always been the fields, villages, and vineyards of their youth, as you see in your text before you as well, all of which are alluded to in verses 11 and 12. In contrast to the streets of the city, the walled enclosure of the palace, peopled by the harem, night watchmen, and Solomon, it was the bright lights in big city, the red carpets and the nightclubs of Jerusalem that beckoned the average harem girl to Solomon. He could rely on the vision of harem life, a life of ease and luxury, in exchange for that brief moment of losing one's virginity to him. Might never see her again. Solomon relied on this vision to seduce and persuade most naive country girls to join him, but not so Shulamith. As we have seen, she has successfully resisted each enticement of seduction, such that she has now fled the harem for the fields, villages, and vineyards of her youth. She has, ironically, passed her probation. And we know from the history of harem life that each new virgin introduced to the harem, was in a period of probation to see whether she could be groomed and be worthy and ready for the king. The irony is that Shulamith is also in another time of probation with Gong. Will she honor the one man, one woman covenant model of marriage? And what Shulamith does do is telegraph her willingness now to be taken in covenant marriage by her shepherd boy. And it is done in discreet poetic language. This is poetry, remember, okay? This is poetry that we're talking about. First of all, in verse 11, it's time to go home. Come, my beloved, let us go out into the fields and lodge in the villages, right? We saw last week the third and final appeal of Solomon and the harem girls for Shulamith to come back from her flight from the harem. Return, return, O Shulamite, return, return, that we may look upon you. But alas, it was too late. She was already gone. She was feeling strong. She's singing this victory song, as the Eagles might put it. And now, after all of the seductive beckoning of that rock and roll culture of her day, Shulamith now beckons her beloved to that one man, one woman life of covenant marriage in the home. That's the focus of these verses. Come, my beloved, let us go out into the fields and lodge in the villages. In the very first chapter, we saw how she self-consciously turned away her consideration for Solomon's vaunted harem. She said there in the first chapter, I am very dark, but lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon. Do not gaze at me because I am dark, because the sun has looked upon me, right? Very self-effacing in that first chapter. Her life in the fields and villages had darkened her skin, though her intrinsic beauty still shone through. That's why she's being considered for the harem. And with time and grooming in the harem, and we see this feature of the harem in places like the book of Esther, right? Esther is being prepared for Ahasuerus, time of grooming and preparation and probation. Or even Daniel and his companions, he's not being prepared for the harem, but he and his companions were being groomed for an extended period before even entering the presence of the king. Rub off all of those rube manners and give him a haircut and a clean set of clothes, right? Shulamith was being so prepared in her time of probation for Solomon's harem. But now that she has decisively put all of that behind her, she's going home to her fields and villages. We see also that her love has ripened, verse 12. Her love has ripened. Let us go out early to the vineyards and see whether the vines have budded, whether the grape blossoms have opened, and the pomegranates are in bloom. Those of you that are joining us perhaps for the first time in this series, I urge you to go back and read the entire text and perhaps consult some of the other messages too, to see how consistent this imagery is in the understanding of the shepherd boy interpretation of the Song of Solomon. Here in verse 12, employing the classic pastoral language of the field, Shulamith concludes that she is ready for marriage, that her love has ripened, using three pastoral analogies. The vines of her vineyard, once again, this has been a consistent motif throughout the book, speaking of her fertile body. The vines of her vineyard have budded. Her grape blossoms have opened. Her pomegranates are in bloom. Once again, allusions to her physiology. And we've seen how this corresponds to the language of her adjuration, too. That is, it is synonymous language where her love is stirred up and awakened now. She's ready. She has successfully passed her probation and removed all doubt in her mind and in ours, consequently. Love is ready to be awakened. And then thirdly, we see in verse 13, she is prepared to bear children. You're working with poetry here now, right? You expect this to be told you in didactic language that this is what's going on, then you just don't get poetry. Get some poetry in your soul. She is prepared to bear him children now. From verse 13, the mandrakes give forth fragrance, and beside our doors are all choice fruits, new as well as old, which I have laid up for you, my beloved. Great language, great poetry. Spouses, you can sing Song of Solomon back and forth to each other in good faith. Just understand that there's some irony lurking under the surface of here too, right? Okay, good, you're laughing. Then you get it. Yeah, precisely. Verse 13 tells us she's prepared to bear him children. As we observed in our reading from the law, from Genesis, mandrakes, a nightshade with round fruits, tomato-like, potato-like. Mandrakes were considered a sign and omen of fertility all through the ancient world. That is, their fragrance and presence nourished the fruit of the womb. Josephus bears this out for us, confirms this for us as well. The idea of children playing in the doorways is ubiquitous in every culture too. The choice fruits, which also is a poetic double entendre too, for the pleasures which Shulamith promises to her shepherd boy. All through Solomon's rock and roll ballads, we've seen this. All through those three songs that he sung to Shulamith, that he sings to all the harem girls that come for probation, this Elvis of Israel, Solomon, once again, he doesn't come off well, right? Just for background for some of you, Solomon does not come off well in the Song of Solomon, does he? You can see that already alluded to. He writes this in humility at the end of his life, the end of his career. This Elvis of Israel, all through his rock and roll ballads, promised sexual pleasure beyond any country girl's wildest imaginings. But Shulamith and the country boy have eschewed them in favor of the intimacy of covenant marriage. And she promises that the beloved will not be disappointed. The upshot of verse 13. My shepherd boy, you will not be disappointed. And that we are speaking of covenant love and marriage. And there's basically three other ways of interpreting the Song of Solomon. That we are looking at a model of covenant love and marriage with Shulamith and not a random collage of erotic poetry, quote unquote, as the liberal consensus is that just we despair of ever making sense of the Song of Solomon, and what we're faced with is just a collage of erotic poems that we can't make sense of. No, no, no. And it's not some over-nuanced justification of Solomon taking yet another wife for his harem. That's the second approach, that we have two voices here, that of Solomon and Shulamith, instead of three, right? Our theory is indeed that we're facing three voices here, Solomon, Shulamith, and a shepherd boy. And in this, we get the real contrast in wisdom literature. In wisdom literature, there's always a contrast between the Nabal, the fool, and the Chokmah, that is, the wise one. Only with three voices do you get that tension between wisdom and foolishness. So we're not facing this justification of Solomon taking yet another wife for his harem, number 538 maybe, but out of 700, right? But he really loves her. Give me a break, right? That's a fruitless exercise in theological twister, seeing this as only two voices, Solomon and Shulamith. Or this is also not an abandonment of interpretive principle altogether in making of the Song of Solomon an allegory of Christ in the church. Now that's very pious. And it sounds great to be able to wrest Christ from this text when he's not there in the way that allegory presents it. Right? You have to abandon sound interpreters, have to abandon their sound principles of interpretation to wrest the allegorical approach to Christ and the church here. But that we are speaking of covenant love and marriage and not any of these other views is demonstrated for us then in chapter 8, verses 1 through 3. Our next point, coincidentally, verses 1 through 3 of chapter 8. Point 2, beckoned. That's our title because Shulamith is indeed beckoning now her shepherd boy. Beckoned. Biblical covenant love is pleased to be stirred and awakened within the context of village and family. Within the context of village and family. Now the language of these verses speaks of intimacy and familiarity and friendship. The life found within family and community. It certainly is not descriptive of harem life. When Shulamith longs for her shepherd boy to be like a brother who nursed at her mother's breasts, she's alluding in a very effective manner to the closeness of sibling relationships from a very young age when they're contentedly nursing mom. If you've ever seen twins nurse or those kids born in rapid fire, right? I forget what that situation is called, but those siblings nursing, you know the intimacy of the scene being portrayed here. It would not be scandalous to see a brother and sister kiss in public, whereas it would be scandalous for an unmarried virgin to be seen kissing a man. So there's that sense of intimacy between two people here, as if they were brother and sister. We have also consistently observed that the mother, right? This is the third appearance of the mother, of Shulamith's mother. We have also consistently observed that the mother and her room or her chamber or her house, all of them having been referred to, is a metaphor for that place of safety and peace and covenant order. Okay? The mother. And it is in stark contrast to the decadence and debauchery of the harem. The mother in the chamber, too. Once again, we're dealing with poetry. We're speaking of poetry here. The mother in the chamber, double entendre, is a poetic allusion to the fertile womb. The chamber of the mother who bore me, she calls it, back in chapter 3. The chamber of the mother who bore me, i.e., both a room and an allusion to the womb. A room and a womb. The chamber of the mother who bore me. Poetic allusion to the fertile womb, which bears children in stark contrast to the barren harem. Right? The barren harem. Where, when children were born to wives and concubines, they were often sacrificed to Molech. This happened not only in pagan kingdoms, but also in Israel, especially in her later days. Useless eaters. Does that sound familiar? Children who get in the way and are a nuisance to the mother? They've always found justification for being gotten rid of. A woman's right to choose is at least as old as Solomon. Shulamith longs to bring her shepherd boy into this covenant order. That is, I would lead you and bring you into the house of my mother. Implicit here is the life of family and its heritage too. The reality of covenant succession, of which we spoke on Independence Day a few weeks ago. It is, I think, that has inculcated this idea of family and heritage, covenant succession. It's a thing inculcated over a lifetime. She who used to teach me. Here's a young girl who remembered well-taught lessons. Shulamith has remembered well-taught lessons when it counted. That is, under pressure from all the glitz and glory of the Siren Song of Solomon. Parents, this is why it is crucial, utterly necessary, for you to teach your children consistently through their childhood, so that when the pressures of the glitz and glory of the rock and roll culture in which we dwell presses upon them, Shulamith had this when the Elvis of Israel crooned his songs of seduction that made the rest of the daughters of Jerusalem swoon, right? She was not hypnotized, right? She could see through it. She remembered. Now she has returned. They have called out to her to return, right? There's these ironies all through the Song of Solomon. They call out, "Return, return, O Shulamith," right? "So that we may gaze upon you." Well, she has returned. She has returned to her home, to her villages, to her mother's room. She remembered. And now she has returned and is preparing to bring her shepherd boy into this covenant order. That is, to marry in the village, family, and community of her youth. That is what this poetry is telling us. Once again, I emphasize with you, wisdom literature, by its very nature, brings into stark relief two opposing things. One wise, Chokhmah, the other foolish, Nabal. Proverbs does it all the way through, right? These little marbles of wisdom that bring a stark contrast. Ecclesiastes does the same thing. Job is an entire treatise on Chokhmah and Nabal. The Song of Solomon, as wisdom literature, is no different. The fool, the Nabal, is found in the harem. The wise, the Chokhmah, is found in the home of the mother. That is the covenant order in marriage. Once again, our country girl's nickname bears this out for her. We've been calling her Shulamith all the way through. But once again, you know that this is but a nickname, right? That the harem girls have given her in the previous verses. And meant to be sarcastic, too. Once again, her name embodies the same consonants as Solomon's name, but feminized in its vowels so that we pronounce it Shulamith. But you compare Shulamith and Solomon in the Hebrew, and they're the very same consonants. And so they're saying, "You're so wise," right? The harem girls say, "You're so wise, oh Shulamith." Being a bit sarcastic there and calling out to her. The, you know, smarty pants country girl, "You're going home again. Shulamith, you're so wise." But the irony is, she is, isn't she? Far wiser than Solomon here at this juncture. So, we embrace that nickname, Shulamith, because it does describe her wisdom in opposition to Solomon, who is descending quickly into a fool. And the picture of true covenant intimacy and friendship is reinforced here too in these closing three metaphors. Spiced wine, juice of the pomegranate, the intimate embrace. The spiced wine, the intoxicating pleasure of her lovemaking, being very frank here. Once again, you maybe need to take some time with your kids, and this may be a good time for the talk, you fathers and mothers. Because, once again, this is fairly graphic language in speaking of the physical nature of lovemaking as well. Or the juice of my pomegranate, an allusion to her body again. Or the intimate embrace. now to be had in covenant marriage. Well, we've been anticipating this. Solomon has given us that false rock and roll picture of sex and pleasure and intimacy. But now, finally, true pleasure and love and intimacy, even friendship. Even friendship here. Our middle daughter, Katie, and my son-in-law, Chris, have the very strong habit of calling each other friend. That's a kind of perked my ears when I first heard them calling themselves friend. But I love this. Of all the maudlin pet names they could call each other, you know, we've heard plenty of them over our lifetimes, perhaps. Instead, they have chosen to call each other by that all too rare bond among spouses, the idea of friend. Are you a friend with your spouse? Can you say that? How many spouses, despite the love and the dedication they may profess for one another, can call each other friend? Deb and I talked about this just the other day. But indeed, there is this sense of the bond of friendship between Shulamith and her shepherd boy. And then finally, Shulamith brings this section of the song to a close with her fourth adjuration. That brings us to point three, verse four. Beckoned. Shulamith is beckoning her shepherd boy. Biblical covenant love is pleased to be stirred and awakened under the positive sanctions of the adjuration. Okay? Positive sanctions of the adjuration. Once again, as we have observed, Shulamith's adjuration, there are four of them in Song of Solomon, naturally mark off the major sections of the Song of Solomon. Okay? We can outline the Song of Solomon by the four adjurations. Once again, for background, you should know that for centuries, many commentators have despaired of ever finding any order or structure to the song. That's why many of them just throw up their hands and say, oh, this is just a bunch of erotic poetry. You know, nobody preaches it, right? Have you ever heard a series preached in the Song of Solomon? That's because nobody can make heads or tails of it without this framework, I tell you. The adjurations help to structure the Song of Solomon. And here, this adjuration functions to close the last series of songs. The last series of songs of the paired Hokmah, the wise, and the Nabal, the fool. Right? We just heard her song of wisdom in contrast to Solomon's last pitch, right? Return, return, oh smarty pants, country girl, right? Now, next week, we'll take up the epilogue where Shulamith will give us her distilled wisdom from her experiences. Don't miss that. That's kind of like the summary of what she's been through, what she's concluded finally, right, about all of this. So she'll give us her distilled wisdom next week. But here, she bids adieu to the harem and implicitly to Solomon with a sense of vindication now, too. There's a sense of vindication here. That love, now that love has been stirred and awakened. All of you have been skimming the pleasures of covenant love for years now, cynically. Now I am about to experience the true blessings and bliss of covenant love. It has been stirred and awakened. First of all, you have, once again, just in review, you have the adjuration, which is a call to swear to a solemn covenant oath. That's what an adjuration is. We saw it in our New Testament reading. Even the high priest could call the Son of God to swear in solemn oath. The daughters of Jerusalem, as we have seen, are the beautiful harem girls of Solomon who have been enlisted to help persuade Shulamith to join them. And then thirdly, we have the stirring, the awakening of love. Do not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. That is a poetic way of saying, don't skim the fruits of covenant marriage sex and intimacy and pleasure without investing its responsibilities. That is family, mutual fidelity, a one woman, one man relationship, and the oaths to God and man as well. And this adjuration then at this juncture serves as a kind of last appeal as well. It's addressed to the harem girls, and it serves as a kind of last appeal to them to reconsider their place in life. We've seen hints of this. Because immediately, by putting them under oaths like this, they must either A, eschew the oath and implicitly admit their guilt, or B, swear the oath and leave the harem. Puts them in a kind of a dilemma. This is her fourth time in swearing them to adjuration. And we've seen there's already been a schism within the harem. That's the upshot of that dance between two armies that we saw last week, right? This has taken root in the hearts and minds of some of the harem. Bit of a schism there, that dance between two armies. There's been a division in the harem. She's calling them once more. Note as well, she no longer invokes the previous witnesses, the those of the field, right? Because witnesses now stand in the harem. Will they swear this oath? If so, who and how many? Shulamith has sworn this oath, and now she is ripe, as our text tells us, now she is ripe for swearing another oath. That is that of biblical covenant marriage. And in being faithful to this biblical covenant of marriage, she's our heroine, isn't she? She's our heroine of the Song of Solomon. If you're looking for feminine role models and feminine heroes these days, don't go to the women's studies of the faculty of your average university. You won't find them there. Look to Shulamith. Look to the Song of Solomon, and there you will find a true biblical heroine, a model after which you may shape your life as a woman. In being faithful to this biblical covenant of marriage, she's being faithful to Christ as well, right? This is a model, as we fast forward to the New Testament, that is used as a model for Christ in his church. Paul says, to the Corinthians, I have espoused you to one husband, Christ. And if Shulamith were to hear Paul speak of marriage as the mystery of Christ in the church, right? Does he not call it that in Ephesians? He says, I'm telling you of a mystery. That is Christ and his church. If she were to hear it, she would immediately exclaim, Amen! She'd know precisely what he was talking about. And she would equally be found faithful to Christ. We can say that of her. And there is an unbreakable link between covenant faithfulness in marriage and idolatry, too, isn't there? Those who are sexually immoral are subject to idolatry. And those who practice idolatry are subject to sexual immorality. One follows the other. There's no escaping it. It's demonstrated in Solomon's life, isn't it? The life of the harem would lead him to the life of the idol in his life. We've seen in the churches of Revelation, too, as we concluded the book of Revelation, the Nicolaitans, those of Jezebel, the followers of Balaam, all of them practice the same basic things, idolatry and sexual immorality. One follows the other. That's why it's crucial to follow the wisdom, not of Solomon, but the wisdom of Shulamith here, right? Namesake of Solomon. Follow the wisdom of Shulamith, not only women, girls, ladies, but also men. She demonstrates wisdom for all of us. Well, let us then now come to that place where we do find wisdom. Wisdom of the bridegroom, Christ's presence in anticipation of the great wedding feast to come, right? That we find in Christ's body and blood in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.